You're listening to Recovery, Healing, Outreach, and Awareness, a podcast about domestic violence, sponsored by Randy's House of Angels. Domestic or intimate partner violence is a complex and silent epidemic that affects millions of people worldwide. To respond to the overwhelming issues associated with domestic violence, Randy's House of Angels has produced a series of podcasts that will bring this epidemic to the forefront of public consciousness and break the silence that often shrouds it. This is Paul Miller, producer of this program, and by creating a dedicated platform, Randy's House of Angels hopes to create a safe space for survivors, advocates, and experts to share their stories, insights, and knowledge. A series of topics will be discussed that can offer vital support and resources to victims and survivors, helping them realize that they are not alone and that there is help available. It can also serve as a catalyst for raising awareness and fostering necessary conversations within families, communities, and institutions to empower individuals, foster empathy, and inspire collective action toward eradicating domestic violence while creating a safer, more compassionate society. We invite you to access the podcast by going to randyshouseofangels.org. Today, we are discussing how trauma-informed care is reshaping probation practices and why. Also, we will discuss how adverse childhood experiences, including exposure to intimate partner violence, impact youth in the system. We will look at the link between teen dating violence and juvenile justice involvement. Additionally, we will discuss how family involvement affects youth outcomes in the system, as well as the role of healthy relationships in preventing delinquency and resources for families navigating the system. Joining us today is Bill Keim. Bill Keim is the supervisor of the Juvenile Court Consultative Program in the Juvenile Court Judges Commission. His career began at Berks County Juvenile Probation in December of 2007 as a line probation officer, and later became the liaison for the office to all Western Pennsylvania placements. In 2016, Bill became the Assistant Chief Juvenile Probation Officer and was promoted in 2023 to the Deputy Chief of the Department. Recently in 2024, Bill accepted a position with the Juvenile Court Judges Commission as Program Manager of Strategic Operations. Bill Keim's career includes developing best practice protocols for the implementation of evidence-based services, includes collaboration with juvenile justice stakeholders in each of the 67 counties in Pennsylvania to identify practices for effective implementation, and assists in developing statewide resources to replicate implementation in all counties. He is also involved in several statewide committees, including the Juvenile Justice System Enhancement Strategy Leadership Team, where he is the Stage 3 co-chair. Bill holds a Bachelor of Arts in Criminal Justice from Pennsylvania State University and is pursuing a Master's degree in Administration of Juvenile Justice from Shippensburg University. Today's podcast facilitator is Sherry Peters. Sherry Peters, a master's level social worker, is a nationally recognized facilitator in the children's mental health field and currently serves on the board of Randy's House of Angels. Formerly the director of the Psychiatric Residential Treatment Facility Waiver Initiative at Georgetown University's National Technical Assistance Center for Children's Mental Health, Ms. Peters also spent 21 years in leadership positions in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania's Office of Mental Health and Substance Abuse Services, addressing children's mental health policy and program development. This includes suicide prevention and trauma-related issues. In her early career, she spent a decade as a therapist in residential and community settings.
So welcome, Bill. So nice to have you here with us, representing the juvenile justice system in Pennsylvania. I want to hear more about what is actually happening to change practice due to trauma-informed care and an emphasis on that.
I'm happy to be here. It's an honor. Thank you.
So talk a little bit about how the juvenile justice system is evolving. We know that trauma-informed care has been something that's come into a lot of different systems in Pennsylvania, including juvenile justice. So I don't know if it was, 10 years ago, 5 years ago, but give us a little history. What's happening?
Sure. So I've been in the field for about 19 years now, and it looks a lot different now than it did then. We knew about trauma, but we weren't gathering data on it. We weren't talking about it very much. But if I rewind, the beginning of my career, I was a probation officer in Berks County. I was in charge of placements on the western side of the state. So juveniles that got in trouble that were high risk would go to placement and work on themselves and become better people. And while I was meeting with them there, I realized that as I was talking to them, they would talk a lot about trauma and things that they've been through in their lives. And it just so happened that those were the higher risk kids. So when they got out, it was, now what? They're going back to the same place, you know, perhaps where the trauma happened to them, and something needed to change. So as you said, about 10 years ago, we started to apply some assessments. Juveniles coming into the system, what was going on with them, kind of get a snapshot of what they had been through, what was still affecting them, and try to put some things in place that would help them moving forward. So about 7 years ago, Pennsylvania started the Trauma Project, where we started using the child trauma screen, as well as the MAISY 2 assessment at intake to, like I said, get a snapshot, what's happening, how can we help right now? Since then, it's really taken off. Counties are coming on board all the time, implementing the assessments and making sure they have providers in the community that are able to help pass probation. So probation officers are assessing, but they're not the experts. They need to make some referrals to get these kids to places that can help them, you know, professionally. But we're creating trauma-informed case plans that we're putting that first. And how can we help them right away that's going to have an impact across their lives in every domain?
So give us an example of what a trauma-informed care case plan might include.
It's putting trauma first, that we're not re-traumatizing them, that we're making sure they're in a safe place in their home. That's probably first and foremost, is should they be there, is it safe for them to go back there? And then it's getting people in part of the case plan that we're making referrals to places where they can go to counseling, they can go to therapy, but they're in a safe place to talk about it. And probation officers, you know, are very different now than they were 15 years ago. It used to be, here are the court-ordered obligations, making sure you're paying your fees and you're doing community service, you're going to school. And now it's more about what's going on at home. When we're trying to make change, we're trying to make behavior change. And a lot of that has to do, we're incorporating, you know, the trauma and making sure that they're able to talk about it and there's not a stigma around it. And we're, you know, it's okay, you're in a safe place. So.
So there may not have been enough time yet to know whether there's different outcomes, but maybe there has been enough time. So can you talk a little bit about what you're seeing currently when young people go through the system with a trauma-informed care case plan as opposed to what used to happen before anyone was really paying attention to trauma?
Yeah, that's a great point. So I think current studies are saying that juveniles not in the system, about 1 in 4 have been affected by trauma. But kids in the juvenile system, it's about 3 in 4. Some studies say higher.
Yeah, I would think maybe 4 out of 4.
Yeah, right. we're seeing, and that's some of the studies that are being done right now. We're involved in a few of them through different universities that are taking a look, as well as the Juvenile Court Judges Commission. We're running studies all the time. And what we're seeing is that juveniles that were high risk and had a lot of trauma were able to make an impact. And it's not only lowering their risk level to recidivate at the end of their supervision, but they're in a much better place. You know, they're able to talk about it. We're involving parents, families are coming in, and it's a whole system. You know, it's collaborative. It's not just the kid and the probation officer. It's the family making changes. It's the juvenile. You know, there's no stigma around going to therapy and counseling anymore. That's part of probation now. So I think we're seeing a difference. It may not show up on paper, but when you talk to kids that have gone through and gotten the help they needed, you see it.
Yeah. So anecdotally, you would see it. So say more about how families are involved now, as opposed to perhaps what used to happen when families weren't nearly as involved or invited to participate in the process.
Yeah. I can remember being a probation officer and hearing the words from parents, well, I'm not on probation. My son's daughter's on probation.
Right, right.
And although that's true, they're a part of the family and, you know, you're there to support them. We see parents, that's much more the case now where, how can I help? You know, it's not fix my kid. It's how can I help fix my kid?
Yeah, yeah.
They're a part of the sessions. We're doing behavior change with them. So they're a part of the probation officer session. We're talking through what it's like at home, what are some problems, we're role-playing with them. You know, we're giving them the power to make the change, because probation's not always going to be there and the juvenile justice system isn't going to be there, but they need to be able to be safe in their home and work through things past probation.
Yeah.
So families have really engaged and understood that we're not there to, the juvenile justice system isn't there to harm them, to take them away, to put them in placement or detention. It's about creating change and making them better people.
So I'm curious about the connection between domestic violence and the young people that come into the juvenile justice system. Are there any statistics that you have on how common that is, that they've witnessed, perhaps, maybe have not been abused themselves, however they may have witnessed some sort of domestic violence? I'm just curious to know whether you track that kind of thing.
We do. The child trauma screen captures that. So it's really two different sections. And the first section is about experiencing trauma. And that breaks it down to witnessing violence, being a part of physical violence, sexual abuse, or other violence.
Yeah.
And that, what you brought up, the witnessing violence, that's far and away the number one thing that young people are experiencing. About 9 out of 10 kids are witnessing some sort of violence. And
that's,
a lot of
that's pretty high, yeah.
It's very high, yes. And it's a lot of that is what you said, it's intimate partner violence.
Yeah.
They're seeing it at home or they're being a part of it.
Yeah. Based on that, obviously your focus now on trauma-informed care in the case planning is an extremely important part. And you talked before about making sure that young people are going to be safe when they go back into their homes, or they're safe now if they're not in a placement. Mm-hmm. How do you see that sort of safety issue playing out as you work with families?
So that's a part of, you know, kids have to work on themselves, right? But the family, where they're going back to, they have to work on that issue as well. So it's not just about the kid, you know, getting help, becoming a better person. The family, and that's what I was talking about, the engagement, they're the ones that also need to work on themselves. And maybe that's recognizing that this wasn't a safe place, that we need to use different wording, that we need to have different boundaries. And that's a big part of juvenile probation now is, like I said, it's a collaborative effort. So when they're going back home, kids are learning skills that they're using, they're applying at home. We're role-playing, hey, I'm the parent, you know, you're the kid, and let's talk about it. What's it going to sound like? And we give it a shot, and they're going to go home and try it out. You know, maybe it's a difficult conversation they wanted to have with their parents. You know, I hear you guys fighting. Is it something we can talk about? If it doesn't work, they come back to the drawing board, and we role-play it. We talk through it again, and they give it another shot. But probation officers are also reaching out to the families and making sure that, is there any way we can help? Is there any, you know, referrals we can make to get someone else involved? Lots of different agencies are going into the home besides just probation. It's they're going into to work with the families. You know, it's going to have a great impact on the kid after probation.
So that's an interesting piece that I'm assuming, I don't know this, but I'm assuming that the idea that various agencies and various systems are also working with you and juvenile justice to work with the families. I'm assuming that's relatively new.
It is what they're talking about and what they're focusing on. There's always been agencies we're making referrals and, you know, a different caseworker's coming in. But it's much more family-based now. It's much more that collaborative effort that they're talking to the brothers and sisters in the home. And,
okay, good.
Yeah. Making sure that, you know, a juvenile that comes to our system, they may be, you know, 13, 14, 15, but there might be 5, 6, 7-year-olds in the home.
Yeah.
That we don't want the same thing to happen to.
Right.
And so those agencies are coming in and they're meeting with the whole family to make sure that we're putting an end to anything that's happening that could affect them down the road.
Did you know that we are on season 3 of the Randy's House of Angels podcast entitled Recovery, Healing, Outreach, and Awareness, a podcast about domestic violence? Have you missed out on any episodes? You can always catch up on every episode we've ever recorded by going to randyshouseofangels.org/podcasts. They are in chronological order since they've been released, so go back and catch up on some of the best moments from the Recovery, Healing, Outreach, and Awareness podcast.
So it sounds like you have much more of a prevention kind of focus than perhaps existed 20 years ago.
Absolutely.
So talk a little bit about your new position with the Juvenile Court Judges Commission and how that connects with the work that you've been doing for the past 18 years.
Yeah, it's changed quite a bit. You know, a probation officer, you have effect over, you know, your caseload. It's maybe it's 15 or 20 or 30 kids, and that's great. You're making an impact, meeting with the families and the juveniles, and then, you know, you become a supervisor perhaps, and now you're making policy change and you're affecting juveniles that are involved with the entire county, and then you perhaps move to a position like this where it has an even greater impact, and you're writing policies and procedures and putting trainings in place that are helping probation officers all across the state. So it's just on a broader scale, but I've tried to take what I've learned on the probation side, and once I came over to the juvenile court judges, and what were the gaps and what did probation officers and supervisors need that perhaps we didn't have or we could do better. We can always do better. So now I supervise the court consultant team. That there's 4 of them. They're all across the state. They go into probation offices and they meet with the chiefs and probation officers and the judges, and they make sure that they're supported and that there's anything they need, that they're following, you know, policies and procedures in court and in the system. But it's more about support. It's how can we help?
Yeah. So when I think about juvenile probation officers being out there in the field and the fact that they have a big job to do, I mean, you were there and they're shoes, you've moved up in the world, or maybe you don't consider it moving up in the world. However, what do you think the probation officers in today's world really need in order to support the young people in a trauma-informed care manner?
Probation officer is it's a tough job.
Yeah.
Number one, they have to be safe themselves.
Absolutely.
And they're going into some unsafe situations.
Yeah.
More and more counties have become firearm carrying counties. It's a dangerous job. It can be.
Yeah.
But I think they need the support of their office to make sure that, you know, they're safe at all time. They have what they need. They are heard. You know, their mental health is being taken care of, because, you know, burnout's a big thing in this.
Yeah, absolutely.
So making sure that, you know, they're taking times for themselves. They have some resiliency at home. You know, people to talk to and debrief with. And I think that I was fortunate enough to have that throughout my career, had a great support system at home, friends and family. And I think that's a big part, you know, that's a big part of the job right now, is making sure that probation officers are, their mental health is being taken care of.
Yeah, that's a really important piece. I'm glad that that's happening. Yeah. I'm quite sure that wasn't happening so much 20 years ago.
It wasn't. There are trainings all over the place, and that's something that the Juvenile Court Judges Commission has recognized, and we're making trainings available and all year long for probation officers to take care of themselves. And you're right, that wasn't the case 20 years ago.
Yeah, Yeah. The whole idea that trauma can impact all of us and that we need to take care of ourselves, that self-care piece is so important. And it's really nice to hear that you guys are taking it seriously.
It's huge. It's all across the law enforcement community. Yeah. You know, vicarious trauma, they're seeing and they're hearing it every day. And, you know, for a long time, I don't think anybody was thinking that it was affecting them. And
yeah,
it certainly was.
Absolutely. Juvenile probation officers could have some of their own trauma, but even if they don't, that vicarious trauma through dealing every day with young people who have experienced pretty high levels of trauma is absolutely something that needs to be taken care of.
Yeah. You know, when I started, it wasn't something I thought about. You know, you would put in the extra hours and you wanted to be the best you could at your job.
Sure.
So you were, you know, working at home and taking calls, you know, at night and answering text messages and to kids and families. And that was just a part of the job, but you didn't really disconnect. And that's important. You know, I had a friend, a coworker years ago that when it wasn't being talked about, but we all saw it. You know, he had a very tough caseload, a gang caseload. He was in it for years. And he you know, did a great job, but he would take it home with him.
Yeah.
And he was starting to affect his home life and his work life balance. And it was starting to show at work. And he was becoming frustrated and short of temper. And he needed a change. And it was all about that. He wasn't taking care of himself.
Yeah. Being able to have that balance is difficult. I'm sure you also didn't find that easy.
It's not. And you need some outlets. You know, sometimes it's heavy during the day and you're dealing with a lot of things. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, if kids aren't safe in their home, sometimes they do need to be removed. And that's tough. You don't.
Yes.
And I didn't realize that until I had kids. And, you know, if someone had to take your son or daughter away, you didn't realize it until you had them what that would feel like.
Yeah, absolutely.
And so you needed to be able to find that balance and be able to, you know, kind of shut off the light switch when you went home and now you're with your friends and family and kids, and you need to be able to be present and leave work at work and be home at home.
So I'm wondering, what would you say to a parent that has a child in the juvenile justice system to bring them a little bit of comfort?
I'd probably talk about the difference between, you know, 20 years ago and now. We're not here. No one in the juvenile justice system wants to see a juvenile removed from their home. That's the last thing that we want to happen. We want them to stay home, be safe, but make changes. You know, they made a mistake, and lots of times that's all it was. Kids make mistakes. You know, their brains aren't developed for another 10 years probably after we see them for the first time, maybe 15. Parents need to know that we're not there to, you know, hurt them. We're not there to cause problems. We're there to help, but we need their help as well, because, you know, we can teach them skills, we can meet with them, we can, you know, get other providers involved. But if the changes aren't made at home, you know, unfortunately, we might see that juvenile back again. So they need to be part of the change.
Yeah. When you think back to the young people that you've had on your caseload through the years, is there any particular situation that stands out for you that was pretty impactful for you?
Oh, yeah. So the one that always comes to my mind, I had a juvenile that he was a great kid outside the home. Whenever I met with him, you know, we were able to joke and have great conversations, and he said all the right things to me. And I really felt like he wanted to make a change. He had gone to placement and gotten out, and he was really on a great path. But at home, things were happening that were out of his control. His mother and his stepfather were selling drugs out of the home. And one day I got a call from the police department to show up there that his parents had been taken away. When I showed up, the door, I pulled across the street and looked across the street at the home where he lived, and there was no more door. It was just splinters on the ground. When I walked over, his grandmother was cleaning up, trying to clean up what had happened, but the police came that day and they took the door. And the whole ceiling was pulled down. There were ceiling tiles everywhere. Couches were turned over. And this young man was sitting at the table. And I sat down next to him, and we didn't say a word for about 5 minutes. He was crying and just giving him some time, being there with him. And he said to me, I can't do this anymore. I need to make a change. And I said, let's do it. How can I help? And so that young man asked to be taken to shelter, which doesn't happen, right? Kids don't want to go.
Right, exactly. That's not a place that kids would want to be typically.
But he knew. He had lived through this his whole life. He was probably 15 at the time, and he knew that that was the safest place for him, and that's where he needed to be. He needed to be out of the environment to make any kind of change. So he ended up going to shelter, and we found a place for him that was safe. That young man finished his probation, went on to college. He had two beautiful kids, came back and saw me a couple years after that, and said, you know, you saved my life. And I said, no, I didn't.
Wow.
You did.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah. But you played a big part in it. Yeah. Yeah. Give yourself a little bit of credit there.
He was a good kid.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like you've had some good experiences and maybe even some not so good experiences in the years that you've been a part of the system. Is there anything that you would like to talk about for the benefit of our audience that I haven't asked you about?
We touched on it, and it's that trauma piece.
Yeah.
It's, you don't realize, you know, some kids might have been through a lot of experience, trauma experiences, but they don't have the reactions to them. They've either built resiliency or they have outlets or they, you know, it doesn't bother them as much.
Yeah.
But some kids, it's not going to show right away. You know, something might have happened when they were six and then it comes out when they're 14, you know, it's a trigger.
Yeah.
We need to understand that, you know, some kids, they seem like they're fine on the surface, but they're not. And I think that we need to understand that it's, they sometimes need to trust you. They need to be safe for them to even talk about it. And then you need to be willing to help them and get them the help they need. And perhaps that's just a conversation, but it might be making a referral. It might be getting someone else involved. It's that that family piece, they need to understand that, you know, they need to be part of the change. So I think it's just recognizing that trauma is real. It looks different for different people. And we just need to be there.
What kind of training does the system provide for those juvenile probation officers that have to learn a little bit more about this impact of trauma? What does it take to be a juvenile probation officer in this day and time?
Yeah, training is a big part of it.
Yeah.
You know, there's the safety training, there's the firearms training, there's the defensive tactics to keep yourself safe, but there's this whole other side that didn't exist.
Exactly, exactly.
And now it's about recognizing trauma. It's about recognizing, you know, what's really going on at home. It's about recognizing the driver for them. So they may have a couple of areas that they're high risk in, but it might be because it's the peer group they hang out with. And if we were able to help them change their peers, or they recognize that, you know, it's really these guys that are getting me in trouble, some of the other things might fix themselves. So some of the other trainings, it's becoming trauma informed. It's motivational interviewing. It's learning how to talk to kids and let them talk. And we're not, you know, talking at them anymore. We're not preaching to them. It's letting them tell their story, and we're going off of what they tell us.
Yeah,
that's a big part of it.
Yeah. So when you talk to juvenile probation officers nowadays, because I'm assuming you do connect with folks that are still out in the field, right or not?
Now and then.
Now and then.
Yeah.
Anything stand out for you about the things they say now as opposed to what they used to say when you were out there in the field with them?
It's a struggle for them to find that balance between, you know, these are the, it's difficult for them to, you know, go from a high-risk kid where they're, you know, there's drugs in the home and family dynamics are not very good. And the juveniles aren't going to school and peers are, they might be gang members, they might be gang involved. And on that same caseload, they might have a low-risk juvenile who, you know, made a mistake, and without us being involved, the juvenile system being involved, they may self-correct and be fine. They made a mistake. It's hard for them to go back and forth. So I give them all the credit. You know, they go to one house and they're dealing with all kinds of things. And the next house is, the kid is, you know, he's a great kid and he's going to be fine. And it's really just having a conversation and being someone, you know, positive in their life.
So I'm curious about, you've mentioned gang involvement a couple of times. Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you see as a common thread that goes through the young people that find themselves gang involved?
I would say it probably is a lot of the times they're turning to the gang for someone to be there for them, for protection, for safety. And that might mean that they didn't have it at home.
Okay. Right. But not necessarily, but it could mean that. Yeah. Right,
not necessarily.
Yeah.
But I think that's a common reason that they join a gang. You know, sometimes it might be they want the lifestyle, they want the money and the friends and the fancy clothes and the car. But a lot of times it's because they didn't get what they needed at home somewhere else, and they found it in the wrong place.
Yeah. And so I'm curious about what you found to be successful in helping young people say no to the gang and the gang involvement.
That's extremely difficult.
Yeah.
Because once you're in, there's only a few ways they can get out, and none of them are good. Sometimes families, you know, recognize that it's becoming very dangerous, and they move. Honestly, that's probably the best thing is to get them out of that area and give them a fresh start and a safer community.
So that's part of working with the whole family, like you've talked about before, helping the family to figure out what their role is in helping their young person.
Sometimes it's just opening their eyes to their son or daughter is in a gang, and they can't believe it. Once they recognize, you know, a lot of them want to, of course they don't want their son or daughter in that situation.
Of course. And
they want to make some changes with them.
Okay, so we're going to wrap up here. Is there anything that you would like to say as last words for the audience out there? Words of wisdom, perhaps.
Just thank you to everyone that's in law enforcement and the juvenile justice system. I think everybody's in it for the right reason. Everybody wants to see a change. So just a big thank you to them.
And thank you to you as well.
You're welcome.
Randy's House of Angels is sponsoring Season 3 of a series of podcasts that will serve as a resource to anyone impacted by domestic violence, including parents, guardians, caseworkers, health providers, advocates, teachers, trauma specialists, clinicians, and more, to provide an overview of domestic violence and how to handle situations where domestic violence is present. Season 3 will include a series of 5 podcasts that will include an overview in addressing the mental health stigma in domestic violence situations, the influence of pop culture on domestic violence, looking at the harmful tropes and changing narratives, and addressing trauma-informed juvenile probation and breaking the cycle for youth. The podcast will include testimony and stories from experts that work in the domestic violence field, criminal justice, juvenile justice, and social work academia. The podcast will be broadcasted starting in August of 2025 and run through October of 2025. Go to Randy's House of Angels website at randyshouseofangels.org. There, you can catch up on any podcast you've missed, find additional resources that support the podcasts, and we encourage you to click on the link and take our short survey. Your feedback is essential to shaping and informing future episodes of this show.